You mean in terms of the remarks?
Hello, yes. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're here with Greg Bernstein, of course, Baltimore City State's Attorney. Welcome, Greg. Good to have you back in the studio.
Thanks, Mark. Always great to be here.
The lines are open. You say that now. The lines are open at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages, which I'll check in a moment. I saw some of you wrote something. I'm not sure about this or not, but I'll look. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We've had one person write in thinking you were coming on the show today to talk about movies. I said, no, that's after Greg Bernstein leaves.
I'd like to talk about movies, but people who know me, they know that's one of my loves. So
one day we'll have you back to talk about movies.
I would like to do that.
So a couple of things. Let us begin. We did not have a chance to – we haven't spoken actually officially on the air since last year. And so we didn't have a chance really to talk – at all about the Tyrone West decision made by your office. So let's begin there, if you don't mind.
Well, no, not at all. And as we announced at the time, we concluded that the officers who were involved used a reasonable amount of force in an effort to subdue a suspect who was actively resisting arrest. And of course, as everyone knows, Mr. West tragically died during that incident. I can't stress enough that the loss of any life is tragic, no matter what the circumstances. You know, as the state's attorney, I take my responsibilities extremely seriously, and any loss of life is frankly, Mark, tragic, and life is sacrosanct no matter who you are, where you live, or where you come from. And my assistant state's attorneys are trained and instructed that we will prosecute anyone who engages in that kind of conduct. But Mr. West, based on the report of the medical examiner, concluded he died from cardiac arrhythmia, which really just simply means his heart stopped beating. And they list a number of factors that contributed to the cause of that death, including some abnormalities in his cardiac conduction system, which simply means there was some degree of abnormality in the mechanism that controls the rate of the heart beating, for example, scarring on tissue, things of that nature, that was exacerbated by or complicated by dehydration. He had elevated electrolytes, as well as the exertion and the excitement of what, according to all the witnesses, was about a 10-minute encounter in which he was fighting with the police officers, and finally when he was in police restraint. Now, in any autopsy that the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner performs whenever there's been a death, takes two parts. The first is, what is the cause of death? Okay, how did the person die? But then the second step is, well, what was the manner of death? And the best example of that, and I mean no disrespect, it's a little gross, but when someone is shot and killed, it's pretty easy for the medical examiner to conclude that the cause of death was a bullet to the person's heart, brain, or whatever it might be. That's the cause. But then they have to say, well, what's the manner of death? How did this happen? And that's when you'll have a conclusion that the manner of death was homicide, which simply means that the person or the mechanism by which the trigger was pulled was caused by another individual. People sometimes forget that homicide does not mean murder necessarily. It simply means that an individual is the person who effectuated the cause of the death. In the example that I gave, the shooting of the gun, if in fact it turns out that the person committed the murder without the homicide without justification, with premeditation, all of the legal terms that are necessary, then it becomes murder. But not every homicide is a murder. Now here, in terms of the manner of death, the medical examiner determined that it was undetermined, which is to say they could not say definitively which of the causes that I described were in fact the manner or mechanism by which Mr. West unfortunately died. And the other thing I would say about the autopsy report, because I know there's been a lot of discussion about this on your show, on other shows and the like, about Mr. West having been beaten to death, having, you know, broken bones, things of that nature. Well, you know, the simple truth is that's just not true, that there was no evidence of any significant injury to any of the vital structures or vital areas of the body. That was the conclusion of the medical examiner. There was no broken bones. There was nothing that was consistent with any kind of beating or other physical harm. I mean, the examination did not establish that. There was a lot of, not a lot, but there was some superficial or abrasions on his elbows, on his arms, which would have been consistent with scrapes from having fallen down and the like, but nothing along the lines about what you've heard in terms of severe kind of physical injury. And finally, on the subject of the autopsy report, no evidence of him having been tased. I know there's been some discussion about that. He was not, Mr. West was not tased. The officers didn't have tasers. It just did not happen.
So a couple of things here, and I open the phones. Mike, you're the first caller up. I'm going to come to your call and answer this question, 410-319-8888. I think last year, let me start with this. That it was interesting when our mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, was president of city council and your predecessor was the state's attorney. She introduced legislation and resolutions saying that Baltimore should follow what Chicago does, which is having an independent police review authority that puts all final reports about police shootings online, including complete statements from witnesses and officers, though names can be withheld, that all police officers should have their names revealed within 24 to 48 hours to ensure accountability on the front end, and that the Civilian Review Board here has no power, so that has to be shored up in Baltimore. Even though she's not pursuing this as mayor, these were her ideas when these issues came up when Pat Jessamy was state's attorney. I say that to point out that I think that it goes through all state's attorney's offices, and whether we do need, and some people are calling for Police Accountability Act, where they're saying that these investigations, when it involves the police, should be done outside of the state's attorney's office at the most, at the least, to do what Stephanie Rawlings Blake said when she was president of the council, which was to have all the information out there for the public to see everything.
So you raise, I think, a very interesting point, Mark. I mean, that really we could have a discussion about for an hour. I mean, because you hit on a lot of issues, but I think really important ones. And I think that what I would say first is that I think you make the very, very good point that it's important for people to understand our relative roles. So, and by that I mean, as the state's attorney, my responsibility is to investigate to determine whether or not police action in any case, particularly use of excessive force, which is what we're talking about, rises to the level of criminal culpability. Now, that, of course, is a very, very different standard and a wholly different question about whether or not the officers in a particular case acted appropriately from an administrative standpoint in terms of whether any kind of administrative sanctions should be imposed. It also doesn't take into account the issue of civil liability where there's different standards and levels of proof and things of that nature. And so it's important, I think, for people to recognize, because I certainly do, that I have to be, as the prosecutor, really kind of single-minded in focusing on the facts that are in front of me in order to determine, did the actions of the individuals rise to the level of criminal culpability to warrant criminal prosecution? The subject of, you know, what are the lessons learned here? What decisions might the police department might make about how officers should act in the future with respect to stopping citizens on the street? All of those very, very important issues are really not within my purview. And so the extent to which you want to have – excuse me, I mentioned to you before, I have a bit of a cold. I apologize. But to the extent you raise the question of, you know, do you have an independent board, some type of examination? I mean, those are things I think for the mayor and the police commissioner to discuss. My role is a very narrow one.
But should you – what about the idea of putting up all the results, all the witnesses' statements, all the officer statements, even some with names withheld, so that people can see it for themselves if they think they don't have enough information on from the reports that you give to the public?
Right. Well, okay, another great point. And there already is a mechanism for that, which is the Maryland Public Information Act request. Anyone can file what we call an MPIA, Maryland Public Information Act. Anyone can file a Maryland Public Information Act request for records or files that are in the possession of the state's attorney. Now, of course, if it's an ongoing investigation or if a case has been charged and the like. But once the case is resolved, someone can do it. And in fact, Mark, if I can just finish the thought, in fact, Mark, that's what happened here. I mean, there have been news outlets that made the request, and we turned over our entire file. The family's lawyer, Mr. Pettit, immediately after we made our announcement, made an MPIA request. And everything I'm talking about today and all the information I'm giving you, all turned over. And so there is a mechanism in which to do that already.
So but what about the idea of just having it online, period, just putting it out there for everybody to have?
Well, again, I think that is something I think for the mayor's office and the police commissioner. I mean, those are issues that I'd have to really just think through. It's not really in my purview, so to speak.
Let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, Michael Scott, Equity Matters. How you guys doing?
Good. Welcome.
So I just got back from Texas and doing some disproportionality work, and I just think it's important for the state's attorney to help people understand. You know, there's a difference between knowing, understanding, believing, and then best practices. But State's Attorney Bernstein share with the public his understanding of the difference and definition of the difference between sort of personally mediated racism and sort of structural institutional, and whether or not it exists within the system over which he does have purview and it's connected to other systems, and what we're doing about it. In Texas, they've passed laws for disproportionality and how child welfare interacts with criminal justice, and they've had their state legislature training. But it really starts with acknowledging and understanding and believing. So I'm not sure I understand or know the state's attorney's position on the issue of structural and institutional racism versus personally mediated, reflecting the numbers the disparity numbers that exist within Maryland. So I'd just like to start with basics and get clarity on his thought and position on those issues.
Well, Mike, that's a great question. It is one that, of course, people talk about at length and would make for the subject of, I think, a two-hour show on Mr. Steiner's radio show. And I think what I would say is that it really gets back to the point that I made initially, that as the state's attorney, my responsibility is to look at the facts of each case to determine whether the individual's actions amount to criminal conduct. Now, so whether or not there is, to use your term, structural racism in the city, whether it exists in the police department or any other institution, I think are questions I think that are more appropriately directed to those institutions. But what I would say to you, sir, is that I think it would be irresponsible of me to make charging decisions in any case, much less one involving, you know, police officers, but to make a charging decision about whether to prosecute someone with a crime based on whatever my personal belief might be with respect to the existence of racism in our city.
So, and I think that would be a good discussion to have, Mike, and I know Mike Scott, who does incredible work with Equity Matters. The time we have left here, because it's a brief conversation, we hope that we'll get the state's attorney back soon for a longer, hour-long conversation when his schedule permits and time permits. But when you defended the decision to clear the officers in the Anderson case because they have to analyze split-second decisions, you said, and you noted that Anderson appeared that he was disregarding orders and officers didn't know whether he had a weapon. You said that Baltimore police training guidelines allowed for use of force when someone doesn't comply with police orders and may be trying to destroy evidence, and you said your job was to determine if the officers had overstepped departmental procedures or if they carried out the arrest in different... could have done a different manner. So when that happened, the question is it possible, as some people have said on this program, that maybe the issue is police protocol and policies that are injuring people, and that's the problem? And do we need to begin your office And I've asked Commissioner Batts the same question. Commissioner Batts' office and others talk about what those procedures are and whether they should be reformed in light of the 21st century and the tensions between police and parts of our community.
Well, see, again, you're really on a roll this morning. I want you to know. That's another really great question. And I think it really breaks down into two kind of general issues. I mean, the first is, you know, I try in my job every day that when, I mean, as you might imagine, it's almost like every 10 minutes something new happens, right? There's a case here, a case there. You know, we win cases, we lose cases, and that kind of thing. And I try not to get bogged down on individual cases and try to take the long view and say, what is the lessons learned? How can we institute better practices? How can we do better next time? How can we do things differently next time to make sure, you know, that we're really doing the best job that we can? And I think so in terms of the case involving Mr. West, I think that, you know, when you engage in that kind of analysis, certainly you can have a discussion about really two basic areas. Number one, you know, what are the rules of engagement, so to speak? What are the ground rules that Commissioner Batts and the police department want to train their officers in terms of making stops, right? In terms of what are they out there looking for? What are the indicii of probable cause to effectuate the traffic stop, which, of course, is what happened in this case? You know, what are, again, not to repeat myself, what are going to be the rules of engagement? The second is, you know, once that occurs, I mean, what are the levels of force in which you can use? You know, in this case, of course, the evidence was overwhelming that Mr. West, for whatever reason, you know, was actively resisting, was fighting, was punching the first two officers who arrived on the scene. I mean, the passenger that was in the vehicle with Mr. West corroborated all of that, that they were fighting, punching, and it continued over a long period of time. So that gets into the whole discussion of, okay, given that situation, you know, what are going to be the ground rules, how should the officers react? These are, as to this later point, and I know I'm giving you a long answer, I apologize, but as to this later point, this is a very, very tough, tough question because, you know, it's very easy for you and me or the police commissioner and his deputies to kind of sit down and chart out these rules. But, you know, Mark, these can be very chaotic situations. And when you're a police officer and you're stopping someone on the street, whether, you know, it was justified or not, right? We're not at that issue at the moment. And you don't know who the person is, and you expect them to respond to your commands. And instead, all of a sudden, you find yourself in a very physical encounter fighting. You have to kind of think about, you know, what's going through their mind at the time. We don't look at these cases. The law is pretty clear about this. We don't look at these cases with the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. We look at what an objectively reasonable police officer would do under the circumstances. So in conclusion, I would say that, you know, you make great points about these two areas. It's certainly something that I'm sure the commissioner will focus on going forward.
But do you think it's something you and the commissioner should be doing together as our two top law enforcement officers in the city, not just the commissioner himself?
Well, if the commissioner is listening, he's going to laugh when I say this because I often tell him that – you know, it's not my responsibility to kind of tell him how to run his organization.
No, I wouldn't.
And he
that.
Always laughs. And I always tell him that I'm certainly, but I'm, and I've always said to him, you know, that to the extent that he would want my advice or help, I'm always, you know, willing to give it. And in fact, you know, we already are doing a lot of that at his request and suggestion. We had offered that, you know, we can make our assistant state's attorneys available, for example, to do part of the training for the young cadets and the recruits, and we do some of that already.
Do we have time for one quick question? No, we don't? They're telling me I have to break. Larry, I'm sorry. I know he wants to talk about the conviction rate, but we have other calls coming in. So next time we have to do this for at least an hour, I should say, not at least, an hour so we can get more calls in and have a longer conversation. Greg Bernstein, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
We're going to take a brief break, and on the way out, you're going to hear the sounds of Donald Byrd, one of the great jazz trumpeters. Donaldson, Toussaint Louverture Byrd, one of our great jazz and rhythm trumpeters and sidemen, some of the great people, also did his own wonderful work. And he died on this day in 2013. We play some of his music.